They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried, hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lied. I ain't telling you nothing you don't already know, but the government's been lying to you, Joe. They're shaking your hand while showing you the door to a foreign land, so you can fight the poor, where every Arab is a terrorist and they're hiding weapons that don't exist. You can join a coalition of willing nations willing to kill civilians for the corporations. They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, they lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lie. Tonight is the night that you give up your right to do the Patriot Act and the perilous fight, but you won't remember which country you're in when you wake up in the morning by the dawn's early light. If it reminds you of the Third Reich, you better keep quiet. If you don't like, better watch your backs, cover your tracks, cause you're paying for it all with your federal tax. They lie, they lie, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried, hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lied. Now come on, did you see that presidential smirk? Say don't look now, it's Captain Kirk. He's an arrogant jerk, though likable too, but the Federation's been lying to you. The Federation, the corporation, is supposed to be public radio station. They're violating the neutral zone to promote the imperial corporate nation. Blow up Afghanistan, nuke Iraq, we got the biggest phasers on the block. We're the world's policemen around the clock. You got the comm now, Mr. Spock. To the victors go the spoils, the lithium crystals, petroleum oil. They hate our freedom for no good reason. Arabs and Klingons, it's open season. They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lied. So you know that the government's been lying to you, and I know that it ain't nothing new. That's politicians, that's what they do. They've been lying since 1492. They didn't teach me when I was a kid about all the terrible things that we did. We'll always honor this sacred treaty with a smallpox-covered blanket, sweetie. Agent Orange and napalm, Gulf of Tonkin, Vietnam, Iran, Contra, Watergate. It's a history of the criminal state. We're spoon-feeding it right out of the box. We're fair and balanced, says the Fox, while talk show shills are shouting out, it's liberals we gotta be worrying about. They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, they lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lied. My mom said, really, if the news was controlled by corporate money and held in a stranglehold, I would have heard about it on the TV. If it was really so important, then I would have been told by the newscasters and the pundits and the anchors and their pals, the politicians, generals and bankers. You say they're doing the old bait and switch, but why would they lie? They're already rich. Power corrupts, it's the ancient trend. The list of lies will never end. New lies coming around the bend. Speak truth to power if truth is your friend. They lie to me, they lie to you. They lie to themselves, it ain't nothing new. They lie to the press who passes the buck. They lie to the world, now everybody duck. They lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out. Sing and shout, the truth wins out. Sing and shout, the truth wins out. Everybody knows they lie.
Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. You can listen to this program at 96.5 FM in the Sacramento area. Today's program is Andrew Bacevich on a Decade of War. After more than a decade of war, Andrew Bacevich evaluates the U.S.'s military effort in Iraq, Afghanistan, and other Muslim countries. When and how will these wars end? How are these wars progressing? Andrew takes us through the various stages of these wars. The bending of rules of war has become the current strategy. Assassination and spying on Americans or others are part of this strategy. Andrew claims that the current war is mostly hidden from view. Andrew criticizes Washington for wasting resources on unnecessary wars, of being unaware of the problems facing the nation, and being unable to respond to these problems.
Now I'd like to share with you just a few biographical notes about tonight's distinguished guest. Before becoming a professor of history and international relations, Andrew Bacevich was a career officer in the U.S. Army, serving in that capacity for 23 years. He graduated from the United States Military Academy at West Point in 1969 and served in the United States Army in Vietnam in 1970 and 1971. He later served in Germany and in the Persian Gulf, retiring at the rank of colonel in the early 1990s. Upon retiring from the military, Bacevich turned his energy and attention to writing and to an academic career. He received his PhD in American diplomatic history from Princeton University and taught at West Point and Johns Hopkins before joining the faculty at Boston University in 1998, where he directed the Center for International Relations from 1998 to 2005. His areas of specialization include American diplomatic and military history, U.S. foreign policy, and security studies. Andrew Bacevich is the author of several books, including most recently The Limits of Power, The End of American Exceptionalism in 2008, and Washington Rules, America's Path to Permanent War in 2010. He is also the editor of a newly released collection of essays titled The Short American Century, a Postmortem, that came out, I think, just in March of 2012. All three of those titles, I believe, will be available at the book sale and signing out in the lobby after the lecture. Professor Bacevich is also an active essayist and reviewer, and his essays and pieces have appeared in a variety of scholarly and general interest publications, including the Wilson Quarterly, the National Interest, Foreign Affairs, Foreign Policy, The Nation, and the New Republic. His op-eds have appeared in the New York Times, the Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Financial Times, Boston Globe, and the Los Angeles Times, among other newspapers. So now, without further ado, please join me in giving a warm welcome to Professor Andrew Bacevich.
Well, thank you very much. My wife and I had never visited south of Portland before. I'd been in Portland a couple times giving talks, and so it was very pleasant for us to drive down here today and see your community and this university. And after we were here for a couple hours, my wife said to me, "So what do people complain about?" And I said to Julia, "My wife wants to know what people complain about." And Julia said, "Well, it rains from time to time." And I thought to myself, "Well, if that's your biggest gripe in life, you're doing okay." So, as I understand it, we have until 9 o'clock. So basically, we've got 80 minutes. Is that right? Roughly. And I want to make sure we have enough time for questions. And so we have a little bit of a problem here, and I'm going to ask your assistance. And the problem is that I've got the lecture, but the lecture, there's a short version and a long version. And the short version ends at page 16. And the long version goes to page 25. So the formal title is A Decade of War and the End of the American Century. Up to page 16 is A Decade of War. The rest of it is the end of the American century. And so the question is, in order so that we can have enough time for discussion, do we the short version or the long version? So here's the plan. When I get to the end of the short version, I'm going to pause and I'm going to clear my throat. And if people want the short version, as soon as I clear my throat, raise your hand to indicate that you want to ask a question. And I will take that as an indicator that I've talked long enough. If, when I clear my throat, nobody raises their hands, then we do the long version. Okay? So it's going to take a while to get there, but that's the clearing of the throat's the cue. So with that confusing introduction, let me begin. Several weeks ago, I received an email from a young American Army officer. Let's call him Mike. I've never actually met Mike. He's the friend of a friend. But I had in the past solicited his views on a couple of matters. That's how we had connected. Mike received his commission more than a decade ago, right around the time the enterprise once widely known as the Global War on Terrorism was kicking off. Over the course of that decade, Mike completed several tours in Iraq, by all reports serving with valor and distinction. As I understand it, Mike has also struggled with PTSD. Mike's email, sent not just to me, but to a long list of contacts, announced that he was leaving the Army for good. And his email included the following reflection, and I'm quoting now. During those days, he's recalling his time as a cadet at West Point prior to 9/11, during those days, war seemed only a vague possibility, something that we would never see in a postmodern world that was quickly flattening with the technological revolution. If war was to come, I expected it to be a 100-hour affair, and I would be riding gloriously on a tank, dutifully serving my country. Well, back then, Mike's naive expectations of war were widely shared, both within the United States military and across American society. In a post-Cold War world, in which the most important questions of political economy had been settled, and over which the United States presided as the self-described indispensable nation, war was going to be an increasingly rare occurrence. And when war did occur, the manifest military supremacy of the United States, demonstrated, for example, in 1991's Operation Desert Storm, seemingly ensured that any conflict would be a brief one, ending with U.S. forces unambiguously triumphant. Well, Mike and his fellow soldiers paid a heavy price for such illusions. In his abbreviated military career, Mike knew nothing but war. For those in uniform after 9/11, war became a permanent condition. And Mike encountered little by way of glory, translating U.S. military superiority into politically meaningful outcomes proved to be frustratingly difficult and far more costly than anyone in Washington had foreseen. Preparing to take off that uniform for the last time, Mike rendered his own verdict on America's post-9/11 wars. In a world of us versus them, he wrote, violence only begets violence. Far out there, on the outskirts of modernity, war is still raging. And I'm not surprised to see the renewed strategies of the Taliban and Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan or the Sunnis' reaction to the Shia attempts at pacification in Iraq. These are the most likely courses of action for the have-nots when they feel there is no alternative other than occupation or slavery. Well, that judgment is a harsh one.
Access Sacramento broadcasts great speeches and interviews every Sunday from 6 to 8 p.m., or you can get the podcast at greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
In the markets, I've seen you in the streets and at your political conventions, talking of your crusade, talking of your nation and other things too terrible to mention. And you proclaim your Christianity, you proclaim your love of God, you talk of apple pie and ma. I just got one question and I want an answer. Tell me, who would Jesus bomb? Maybe Jesus would bomb the Syrians, 'cause they're not Jews like him. Maybe Jesus would bomb the Afghans on some kind of vengeful whim. Maybe Jesus would drive an M1 tank and he would shoot Saddam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I've seen you on the TV and on the battleships. I've seen you in the house on the hill. And I've heard you talking about making the world safer and about all the men you have to kill. And you speak so glibly about your civilization and how you have the moral higher ground. While halfway around the world, your explosives smash the buildings. If you could only hear the sound. But maybe Jesus would sell landmines and turn on his electric chair. Maybe Jesus would show no compassion for his enemies in the lands way over there. Maybe Jesus would have flown the planes that killed the kids in Vietnam. Who would Jesus bomb? Yes, I hear you shout with confidence as you praise the Lord and you talk about this God you know so well. You talk of Armageddon and your final victory when all the evil forces go to hell. Well, you'd best hope you've chosen wisely on the right side of the Lord, and when you die, your conscience, it is clear. You'd best hope your atom bombs are better than the sword and the time when your reckoning is here. Cause I don't think Jesus would send gunships into Bethlehem or jets to raise the towns of Timorees. I don't think Jesus would lend money to dictators or drive those SUVs. I don't think Jesus would ever have dropped a single ounce of napalm. Who would Jesus bomb? Who would Jesus bomb? Who would Jesus bomb?
And now back to Andrew Bacevich and a decade of war.
Certainly, U.S. forces do not see themselves as occupiers, and they did not arrive in Afghanistan or Iraq proclaiming their intention to enslave the population. Nonetheless, Mike has more than earned the right to express his views. And what is incontestable is that the wars have not gone as American soldiers had hoped for or expected, nor have those wars produced the happy results that U.S. policymakers had forecast. Mike's disappointment, anger, and bitterness are more than understandable. Well, what went wrong? How exactly did we get here? And what conclusions can we draw from our post-9/11 military experience? Let me attempt to answer those questions by first providing an abbreviated count of recent U.S. military history. With the United States now well into the second decade of what the Pentagon itself has styled a, quote, era of persistent conflict, the war formerly known as the Global War on Terrorism appears increasingly fragmented and diffuse. Without achieving victory, yet unwilling to acknowledge failure, the United States military has withdrawn from Iraq, leaving that country deeply scarred and in considerable disarray. It is trying to leave Afghanistan, where events seem equally unlikely to yield a happy outcome, a point that events of the past several weeks have certainly emphasized. Yet, of course, it is a mistake for us to think that Iraq and Afghanistan alone describe this so-called war on terror. Elsewhere, in Pakistan, Libya, Yemen, and Somalia, for example, U.S. forces have been busily opening up new fronts. Published reports that the United States is establishing, quote, a constellation of secret drone bases in or near the Horn of Africa suggest that the scope of operations will widen further. Navy plans to convert an aging amphibious landing ship into what the Navy calls an afloat forward staging base, in effect a mobile launch platform for commando raids, that also reinforces the point. Yet as some fronts close down and other fronts open up, the war's narrative has become increasingly difficult to discern. How much farther until we reach this war's equivalent of Richmond or Berlin? What exactly is the war on terror's equivalent of Richmond or Berlin? Is there a storyline here? Viewed close up, the war appears over the course of a decade to have lost form or shape. Take a couple steps back, however, and important patterns begin to appear. What follows is a preliminary attempt to chart and to score this era of persistent conflict. My provisional account portrays the war as a sort of boxing match. It divides the bout into three rounds. Although there may well be several additional rounds still to come, and I expect there will be, here's what we've suffered through thus far. Round one, liberation. More than any other figure, more than any general, even more than the president himself, Donald Rumsfeld dominated the war's early stages. Appearing for a time to be a larger-than-life figure, the Secretary of Defense was called the Secretary at War in the eyes of adoring, if fickle, fans. Rumsfeld was dedicated to the proposition that speed holds the key to victory. U.S. forces are smarter and more agile than any adversary. Employed in ways to take advantage of those qualities, they are therefore sure to win. The term the journalists embraced to describe this conflict was shock and awe. And indeed, this was war as Mike imagined it to be. No one believed more passionately in shock and awe than Rumsfeld himself. The design of Operation Enduring Freedom, launched in October 2001, and of Operation Iraqi Freedom, begun in March of 2003, reflected this belief. In each instance, the campaign got off to a promising start, with U.S. troops landing some impressive blows. But in neither case were they able to finish off their opponent. Unfortunately for Rumsfeld, the terrorists, as we called them, played by different rules. In all the ways that counted, U.S. forces proved to be less smart and less agile than their technological edge implied. Indeed, they proved surprisingly slow to figure out what hit them. In Afghanistan, Rumsfeld let victory slip through his grasp, at least in part because he and others in the Bush administration were eager to move on to the next phase of their plan to transform the greater Middle East. The focus of that next phase was Iraq. There, Rumsfeld's egregious mismanagement of the campaign brought the United States face to face with outright defeat. Rumsfeld's boss had hoped to liberate the Islamic world in a series of short, quick thrusts. What President Bush got instead was two different versions of a long, hard slog. By the end of 2006, shock and awe was kaput. Trailing well behind the rest of the country and well behind the armed forces, the president eventually lost confidence in his defense secretary's approach. Rumsfeld lost his job, and round one came to an end, the Americans, rather embarrassingly, having lost it on points. Round two, pacification. Enter General David Petraeus. More than any other figure, in or out of uniform, Petraeus dominated the War on Terror's second phase. Round two opened with lowered expectations. Gone was the heady talk of liberation. Gone, too, were predictions of lightning victories. The United States was now willing to settle for less, and it was going to pay more for that less than anyone had anticipated. In effect, Petraeus offered a formula for restoring a semblance of order to countries reduced to chaos as a result of round one. Order might permit the United States to extricate itself while being able to claim that it had achieved some semblance of its policy objectives. Extrication, without having to admit abject policy failure, became the operative definition of victory. The formal name for the formula that Petraeus devised was counterinsurgency, or COIN. Rather than trying to defeat the enemy outright, COIN sought to facilitate the emergence of a viable and stable nation-state, winning the hearts and minds of the people. This was the stated aim of the surge in Iraq, ordered by President George W. Bush at the end of 2006, following Rumsfeld's ouster. Excuse me. With Petraeus presiding over the Iraq surge, violence in that country declined precipitously. That was not the clearing of the throat. Got to make sure you give the right cues or people can misunderstand. With Petraeus presiding over the Iraq surge, violence in that country declined precipitously. Whether the relationship was causal or coincidental remains the subject of controversy. In typical fashion, however, most American observers preferred to ascribe indications of progress to American actions. After all, it's what we do, not what others do, that matters, at least in our own eyes.
Violence is their answer, the 1% is clear. If we organize for justice, they respond in right gear. 99 want health care for all and for all to go to school. Not poisons in our country driven by military rule. We want a home to live in, We want a decent job. No predatory lenders and banks that steal and rob. No drones in Pakistan. No assassination plan. No wars in Iraq, Iran, Congo, Afghanistan. It's against the law to be a pacifist here in the USA, 'cause the government says we're terrorists and takes our rights away. Yeah, the 99 are the enemy to Romney and Barack. Bill of Rights, civil liberties, they both are trying to sack. Yeah, the Dems and Republicans won't let us in debates. So the only ones at the podiums are corporate candidates. You see, truth spoken to power can only serve to illuminate the hundreds of lies of the 1%, and that might change the state. Yeah, democracy takes integrity. And if you want it back, don't throw your voice away on Romney and Barack. So when it's time to vote this year, if you're not sitting in some jail, don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail. Don't vote for the 1% and let the 99 prevail.
And now for something completely different.